would like to introduce our main speaker, Robin F. from Del Mar.
Oh my gosh, there's a lot of people. Hi, I'm Robin, alcoholic addict. I'm just privileged to be here right now because I know there's a room full of miracles in this room, and I just am trying to take it in right now. And I appreciate my friends being here, and Scott. I really appreciated your share. I related a lot to it. And I'm going to talk about my story, but I'm more going to talk about my recovery. I'm going to talk about my story a little bit and then my recovery with and without the steps, because I spent a lot of years in this program without step work. My sobriety date is January 1st, 1997. I'm 39, so I got sober when I was 26. I'm originally from Johannesburg, South Africa. I was born there. And I guess I'll just start there. I remember I lived right by a township, and it was really violent. And I was pretty well protected where I lived, but I saw a lot of violence when I was younger. And I would try and block it out of my mind. And I know that part of my disease with my spiritual malady is that I feel pain and I want to change my feelings. So I remember early on seeing things that I would try and block out, and I couldn't. And then, but I had a pretty good childhood, young. I had my grandparents and spent a lot of time with my grandparents. And then I remember something happened to my tooth. And I went to the dentist, and they gave me nitrous. I think I was like 7 or 8. And they gave me the nitrous, and I told them I couldn't feel anything because I could feel it. And they kept turning it up and turning it up, and it was like the first time I felt high, and I could forget about that pain from those things that I'd seen. And then I tried to break my tooth for like 6 months after that. I was trying to break my tooth so I could go back to that dentist and get the nitrous. But so that's how it, that was the first time. But we ended up, my family ended up escaping. There was a bomb threat to my house, and I was about 9, and we ended up coming here illegally. We didn't have a passport or anything like that, and so I basically left my whole life behind there, my grandparents, who I lived with most of the time, and I came here with my parents, and my dad didn't have a job. It was pretty bleak. So what happened was my dad got into a very bad depression that he never got out of. But he got into a bad depression, and he couldn't find work, and we were pretty poor, and we'd come from a lot of money, but we could only take a certain amount of money here. So for me, my drinking career started very young. I wasn't 6, but I was 12 the first time I took a drink. I was at that time... my mom was doing facials and trying to get money under the table out of the house, and my dad would be looking for work, and I'd come home, and I just felt alone a lot. I'd come home, and I just didn't have, there was never food or, a family to take care of me, or I just never felt like anybody was taking care of me, and I didn't feel safe. And I was in a new country with new accents, and everything was new, and I just kind of developed a skill of making friends and going over to my neighbor's house, and I'd always be hanging out with the neighbor's families. And the first time, and then I started making friends with the boys up the street, and I was 12, and they were like 16 and 17, and thought it would be fun to, give me alcohol. And I think for me, I was alcoholic from the start. It wasn't progressive for me. I remember the spiritual malady early on. I remember feeling irritable, restless, and discontent very young. But at the same time, I felt different when I was younger, because I always felt like I could almost intuit things. Like, I feel a lot of energy at a young age, and I didn't like that either. I was really, really sensitive to a lot of things. And sometimes I thought I saw things that I didn't really like. And so when I took, the first time I drank, it was like instant love. Like, the minute I felt the buzz, the minute I got that in my body, all I wanted to do was have more. And it was just instant for me. And that started me out. And there were drugs involved too, a lot. And I think I was in my first, I don't know if any of you remember in the 80s, Freeway. It was like this drug rehabilitation group, but oh, you remember. I was in Freeway, my first like rehabilitation type like group that ended up being a cult or something. I don't know what it was. I learned how to smoke. I was 14, and I met a lot of people that listened to heavy metal. I was really heavy metal. Yeah, I like that. And so I was there when I was 14, and then after that, I was in a series of rehabs, psychiatric hospitals, like they talk about in the book, psychologist's office, and then I ended up in a halfway in a Project Oz. It was a group home, and during the time, I had a lot of stuff going on at home. There were a lot of fighting between my parents, and things that I won't get into. But I was it got really ugly for a long time with my dad couldn't control me with the drinking and the boys and everything going on, and he turned very violent towards me for many years. And alcohol was a great escape for me because it helped numb not only the emotional pain but the physical pain that I suffered during those years. And that's still hard for me to talk about. I just remember just running, like just being, going out of my house with all the yelling and the stuff going on, the craziness, and just running down the street, and going to the corner and just sitting there like banging my head on the post, just wishing that somebody would come pick me up. And so, and that's when I started getting, you know, very involved with boyfriends, and I always wanted that person to come along and save me, you know, take care of me and protect me and save me. And I got addicted to my boyfriends, too. It was like I had multiple addictions going on at once. I just really badly wanted someone to take care of me. And, it was difficult at that time because they, you know, you get different people older than you or I did. And I ended up in Hollywood and Los Angeles and just got into some really bad things with some very, very older people and the mafia. I was just crazy for a long time, and my friends did crazy things, and I ended up failing high school because of my drug use. But at that time, the unmanageability and the powerlessness, I thought I was stupid because I couldn't graduate high school, and I was told I was stupid, but I never studied because who's going to be thinking about 5 + 5 when your dad's putting the fists in the door the night before? You know what I mean? But nobody saw that, you know. So it was just really bad for a long, long time. And it was bad. So I moved out of my house when I was 17, and everything continued for me, the boys and the drugs and the alcohol and everything. And then to make a long story shorter, this is when it became unmanageable, and I started realizing, wow, something's wrong. And I know you guys relate to this in the first step. It was like I would wake up and say, I'm not doing this again. I am not doing this again. I'm not, if I drink, I'm not going to get drunk. Or if I do, I won't speak outside, but if I do this, I'm only going to do this much. And if I go out with this person, I only like him that much. And every single time, it was like out to the race, like by like 4 or 5 o'clock, I was doing the same thing again. It was like the same thing over and over and over again. And I started realizing, wow, something is wrong. But the thing is, I didn't know I had a disease, a spiritual malady, a physical craving for more, and a mental obsession. I just thought something's wrong with me. It was like the shame was the, it was like I didn't know about the disease really. You know, I'd talk to people. The only time I can remember somebody actually reaching out to me is when my parents had dragged me into McDonald's Center. And I was like, screw you, fuck you, you know, pounding on the doors. And this guy came and they put me in this room and chained me up. And I said, I hate you. You know, this is my thing with everybody. I hate you. And he said, that's okay. I love you. And I know you. And I'm like, oh my. And all I could think about is I've got to get out of here and drink. I got to get out. And I ran and ran and ran. And I remember when I was running, I was thinking, that guy just like, he got me. Somehow he got me. So this went on, and then what happened for me is that I moved to Santa Barbara, and I thought that drugs were my problem, and I definitely didn't have an alcohol problem because the drugs were really bad. And then I stopped the drugs on self-will, and then the drinking just was like, I mean, it was like 2 years. I can't even really remember much about that 2 years. I just was drunk all the time, and I gained like 25 pounds from drinking. It was just every single night. I had hangover, hangover, hangover. And it was like that thing again, you know, when I started, I could not stop. I could not put it down. But the buzz and the way that it made me feel and the way it made me numb and leave my body, I just couldn't stop. The Big Book talks about the effect produced was so elusive. I just was chasing it. And it was like everything was just totally intense. Like everything was too extreme with everybody. And then what happened was, I thought, something's wrong with me. You know, I got to do something. So I went home, and my dad said to me, "You are really fat." I'd gained like 25 pounds because I was drinking every night. So I thought, okay, I'm really fat, so I'm going to start this diet. And this will save me, and I'll move back home. So I moved back home, and I started a diet. And for me, it was like, okay, you have 3 carbs or whatever, the Jenny Craig stuff. Oh, no, I did Weight Watchers. So if this is okay, then less and less and less and less. So I ended up totally anorexic. You know, it was like 90 pounds, you know. And so what I would do was I was doing the eating disorder stuff. I was running like 5 miles in the morning, 7 miles at night, eating chicken broth. And then I drink to reward myself. So it was like I was, you know, but I thought I was doing well because I was at City. I was doing well because this was so much better than my life before. You know, it was skinny and really skinny. And, you know, and then it would be weird. I'd, like, wait for my parents to eat. Like, I was, like, 4 again, you know. Like, I really wanted. And this time my dad liked this disease because I was, like, really needy and needed help. So he participated a lot when I went to the hospital in my 7-week program. And it was, like, a good girl disease, you know. So I wasn't doing bad things, but. So that was good. I got a lot of attention from that from him. So anyhow, I didn't know that I had, you know, this disease of spiritual restlessness. I was discontented. I knew I wanted a relationship with God, but to me, God was like when I take a lot of drugs and drink a lot and I would see, like you were talking about, like dimensions and other planets. That was my idea of God. Like that was my thing. Like I thought I had this whole world that other people didn't know about, and I'd experienced these dimensions on other planes. And I thought I communicated with planets at this point. So I was like really like suicidal, but really saintly at the same time. It was insanity, total insanity. And so the miracle when God did an intervention on me between alcohol and myself, because I don't believe it was me. I couldn't stop doing any of it, was when I was just wearing all black and I was like 90 pounds and I was writing poetry at coffee shops and, you know, getting good grades. And, you know, at that time, this guy said, this guy Carl at this restaurant, he said, "You know what? I think, are you an alcoholic?" And I said, no, I used to be. I used to be. See, it made me gain weight, though, and now I only drink Jaeger and vodka. Doesn't smell as bad. And he's like, "You know what? Why don't I take you to this meeting, an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting?" And I, you know, been in the rehabs and stuff, so I'd heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, okay. And then I thought, you know what? I'm going to go. These people need to learn something from me. For sure. This is my calling. So, oh my gosh, my first meeting, thank God you guys didn't judge me. I think I was talking about the planets, the dimensions. I said, you know, this is like, I was like, I've got to save these people. And so, and I had cut down. So, you know, I communicated that during my shares. And people said, "Keep coming back." And I was like, "They really, this is meant to be. This is meant to be." So, I came, and then what happened for me, and this is why I want to share about my recovery, is that when I stopped drinking and doing what I was doing, the rage was unbelievable. The rage that I had and the flashbacks of things that had happened when I was drinking and stuff that had happened at home all came back like a lion on my back. It was the 100 forms of fear and self-delusion that the Big Book talks about. And I didn't, it was like, I was frozen. I was triggered by every person that walked down the street, by every single place I went. Something reminded me of something you remember. And it was like a raging lunatic. I mean, I was one of those people that was stone cold sober telling you, like, "Fuck you," across the street. I kicked somebody. I mean, I was like a lunatic sober, total lunatic. I was almost worse sober than I was out there because, and it was this this trauma, you know, all this stuff like coming at me all the time. And I didn't even dawn on me. See, I heard about the steps because I was going to a lot of meetings. But I met with a sponsor, and she said, call me every day. And I called her every day. And then she'd do, like, therapy with me on the phone. But we never cracked the book. And then she had me write a little bit. But see, the thing is, I was getting self-help. And I went to therapists. I was getting self-help. But I was not getting a spiritual solution. Not her fault. She was sponsored that way, too. And I wasn't hearing as much about step work. I know I'm a real alcoholic, and for me, there's no in-between. I was dying of this disease, and I was dying of this disease in sobriety. And I went to hundreds of meetings and didn't drink in-between, and I could not get sane. And so eventually, after about a year, then I met my husband after I was sober 2 weeks, and I met my... So, and the thing was, is that he was the knight in shining. I know you are too, honey, but... he was the knight in shining. You know, I was completely unable to cope with my reality. I had no ability to write checks. Well, I wasn't able to in the marriage either, but that's a whole different meeting and story. But I had no ability to live life on life's terms and do things that people do when they're normal. So when he came into my life, he was, you know, a dentist. He had this wonderful family. I'd never had a family life. And they took me under their wings, and I was like this wounded bird, and he came in, and he was in love with me. And after 2 weeks, he knew I was the one for him, and I thought all my problems were solved. You know, this guy is my higher power now, and I don't have anything to worry about. He's going to protect me from the world, and I'm okay now. And this was my higher power. And so he took me under his wings, and I moved into his house, and he was extremely strict with me. Which was great for me. I'd never had a dad like that. So, what I did was I ended up going to another treatment center when I was sober a year because I wasn't able to function. I was really going to meetings and not drinking between 3 meetings a day, but I couldn't leave the house or do life at all. And it was like the panic attacks were unbelievable all the time. It was like 1,000 forms of fear and self-delusion were chasing me. It wasn't until I did steps that I turned around and it was a chihuahua. You know what I mean? I just heard that recently. But so I did 8 years, 8 years of hundreds and thousands of meetings and no step work. And when I did the step work, it was not out of the big book. I got all these like filtered down, I'm not going to say the names of these other peoples, but I got filtered down step work and I never had a psychic change. As change of depth and weight that would take me further in every single area of my life. But I was sober, but I relapsed in my other addictions. So I am sober 13 years, but I really almost died of my eating disorder in this program. I relapsed with that, and the thing is that everything looked good on the outside. I had a nice house in Del Mar. I lived with this wealthy guy, this wealthy family. We had a dog and, you know, all this stuff that everybody thinks they want. I ended up going, I got my college degree. I got my master's degree between all this. And because I thought if I had the degree and I wouldn't be stupid anymore. And if I had the guy, I'd be okay. And I had everything that I thought was going to fix me. And I thought I had a relationship with God, and I did, as far as God removing the alcohol and drugs from my life. But I didn't. I was agnostic in all other areas of my life. I was totally, and I didn't know I was. If you said, Robin, do you believe in God? I'd say, yes. I go to thousands of AA meetings. I say the Lord's Prayer. I say, God grant me the strength. I didn't have a personal relationship, and I was totally agnostic as far as, okay, God, you're not taking this relationship from me. You're not doing this with that mother-in-law of mine who's practically sleeping in my bed. You know, whatever it was, I wanted to read on page 52 about the bedevilments. This is what was happening. It says, we ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our own human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. We're having trouble with personal relationships. I was sober, dead sober. I was having trouble with personal relationships. Couldn't control our emotional natures. Oh, my God. I mean, like, every day, up and down and up and down. Just depending on how you treat me is how I felt. we were prey to misery and depression. The depressions got so bad, I was just in my house. He wouldn't let me leave anyway, but I was in the house, and this mail, the lady that I wasn't allowed to get the mail, but she'd say, like, why is that girl always at home? Why is she always in her house depressed, you know? Prey to misery and depression, not able to make a living. Well, I had a lot of education behind me, and I got a license, but felt totally shame and like something's wrong with me and I can't do anything. I can't make a living. And I had a feeling of uselessness. I wasn't sponsoring. I didn't know how. I just didn't feel like I had a purpose in life. I just, you know, felt a lot of times like I was just wasting space. And like, I just had this hole in my heart all the time, this shame and darkness, you know, all the time. And it was so hard because I was sober and I was going to a lot of meetings. And I didn't know what was wrong, you know? Like, all these people in the program seemed to be having lights turned on, and I couldn't. And I'd go to these dual diagnosis meetings, and it was like, it was just really hard. And I was full of fear. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be a real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. When we saw others solve their problems by simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but God's idea did. So I had a spiritual experience, and I had a baby. That was it. You know, I tried everything, and that didn't work, so I was going to have a baby. So I thought that was fixed the marriage. And so I had the baby, and I went into another round of insanity. That one was, I had another relapse with my other addiction, and at that point, I was about a day away from being checked into Mesa Vista. And my sponsor at the time, Tyla, they were giving me a ton of benzos. They were trying to give me a ton of benzos, and I was really loony. I mean, and she called me, and she said, what'd she say? She said, Robin, and she said, you know what? Have you ever really worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? Have you? And I said, what do you mean? I said, I've been to thousands of meetings. She said, have you had a spiritual psychic change that revolutionized your ideas, that was a complete change, not in what was around you, but in yourself? And I'm like, no, I haven't. Myself feels like a piece of shit all the time. I don't even want to live anymore. I cannot take care of this baby. I didn't even want, I loved this baby so much, but I could not take care of the baby. It was really bad. And I loved this baby more than anything, but I could not take care of this baby. And I was sober. So she said, Robin, I'm going to meet with you once a week for 2 hours, and we're going to go through the steps. And at that point, I was so desperate. I would, if she told me, go, like, dress and, you know, do whatever down the street, I would do anything she said at that point. But in the back of my mind, I thought, maybe it won't work. I just didn't think it would work. You know, there's always a doubt, and I still have that doubt when I go through the steps. And so I started meeting with her once a week, and we started going line by line through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, turning statements into questions. And what happened for me is that I got my powerless and unmanageability in step one in sobriety. In sobriety, my life had become so unmanageable. My disease of alcoholism, irritable, restless, and discontent, penetrated every single area of my life, and I was in an absolutely miserable situation. I was absolutely miserable inside my heart, and I saw that I have a physical allergy that whatever it is, but I'll use alcohol since we're in AA. When I take alcohol in my body, I physically crave more. And you guys know what that's like. I get the buzz and I want more. That's all. And then this mental obsession. I will obsess. I get total tunnel vision about my addiction. And then the spiritual malady is that I, in the first place, have a spiritual disease that needs to be treated before the other two would get straightened out. Because I always thought I had to get physically clean first or lose the obsession. The spiritual would work itself out eventually, but I didn't realize that spiritual had to come first. And then, you know, in step two, that again, I had to look at my agnosticism. I had to go into the steps as if I'd never been into that one meeting. And I saw agnosticism, like I said before, all over my life, I absolutely was agnostic, except in the area of the removal of drugs and alcohol. And I used to hear my friend at meetings saying, you've got to get a big God. And I really needed a big... I didn't need God to keep me spiritual. I needed God to keep me sane and sober and normal. I couldn't live like this anymore. This was like living in a whole different dark dimension of reality sober, with all these nice things and these trips and going here in limousines. You know what I mean? I'd gone from this end to that end, and I was still the same. And so I did that in step two, and we studied that book. I mean, it was like, and something started to shift. When I gave my, and then in third step, when I gave my will and my life over to God, that's a huge decision. I'm dealing with real power here. When I do that, I'm saying, God, you take me, every single thing in my life, if you take away from me and replace it, I don't know, but I'm willing to do anything right now that is in your will, because I cannot run the show anymore. I am done with my way. I was that done. Like, whatever you take away. And the worst fear for me is and having that marriage end. I was absolutely terrified because I'd never taken care of myself. I'd never taken care of myself. I didn't know how to write checks. I didn't have, you know, any skills as far as I thought. And that was my biggest fear, is that what if I do this and the marriage will end? And that was my higher power. He was my higher power. I was afraid of him, really afraid of him. And so that was that. And my friend Mark Houston, who's passed away, he said, you know what, Robin? Sometimes you just have to jump off and know that you're going to be held. You know, that God is either everything or he's nothing. He's not halfway. He's either everything in this area or he's nothing. So I was, you know, spent. And then in the fourth step, I had done little mini steps, you know, with people, but they always talked about these character defects and stuff. I never really got to the fears behind them. And the resentments that I had were just, you know, people get in, they're like, I don't have any resentments. I'm like, are you kidding? Like, I can get resentment in like an hour. I had so many resentments. It was unbelievable. Like, I don't get that. When I know that some of you don't have resentments. I just wasn't that person. And so the resentment inventory for me was really powerful, because I had to see how me running the show and trying to direct the show and trying to tell people their lines and trying to control this and control that did not work, and that I needed to trust that God was going to start running it for me. And at that point, my marriage started ending. Things were really coming to an end there. It was an unlivable situation for me. It got pretty bad. And I won't go into those details, but it was very, very prison-like. So, and another thing that was hard for me on my fourth step was putting my dad down. It wasn't hard that I knew I had a resentment about him, but one of the reasons I really didn't want to get into that fourth step is because I know as a child I didn't have a part in what happened with me. I know that. The part I didn't see is how I took that anger out on every single man that came my way. That was the part I couldn't, I did not want to look at that resentment. And by the way, I have total peace with my dad now. It took me 11 inventories, but I do. And that's a miracle in itself. So, and then I did that four step, and I was, you know, got to those fears, fear of not being good enough, fear of being rejected, you know, a lot of fears, fear of, my biggest one was that I was wounded beyond repair, that I would never, you know, be able to function, to love again, to be loved, to experience joy, to experience hard stuff without picking up anything. That was this huge fear of mine. And so I got to all those fears, and then I was always told, like in meetings and stuff, that 6 and 7 was like you ask God to remove the character defects, and then you tell him which ones. I don't know how that got in my brain, but so that's, like I said, I had to go in like, this is a whole new experience, as if I've never been in one AA meeting, because the ego would tell me, you know this stuff, you've been in thousands of meetings. So 6 and 7 for me was, you know, that humbling prayer between me and God of that, these are my lists of fears, God, and I don't know what you're going to remove from me and what you're not. You might keep, I might have to keep some of these to take me into what you would have me be. See, because I never once thought, God, make me into who you want me to be so I can be of service. I just wanted to be, God, make me who you want me to be so I can get rid of this pain, right? God, please, just take me and do what you want with me so I can go and share my story and not have shame so that somebody else that has been through that can benefit from my experience and I can work the steps with them. I never looked at it like that until this step. And so that started, I mean, just the power of God started flowing in my life as if oxygen had, as if I was dying in AA and I was on a tank or something, and that slowly, piece by piece, the tank started coming off and I could breathe fresh air. That's what it felt like. It was, but the thing is it was excruciatingly painful. The step work was painful. I had to look at things that I'd been running from in my whole sobriety. Things from my past, things that had happened, things that I had done, things that I could never think that I'd forgive myself for or that I'd never get healed from. And so I did that in 6 and 7. And then in 8 was just making the list. It wasn't knocking on the door. And carefully reviewing those with my sponsor, because I had some ulterior motives a lot of times in my amends. Amends are a process, because it says completed all amends, and amends, that means all of the amends. So even if it, you know, I'm still working on some, and it's been 5 years since I did this set of work. I mean, I've done it many times, but. So, you know, as this started happening in my life, this power, a sense of peace did start coming in like I hadn't felt. Now, see, for me waking up every single morning thinking, how am I going to get through today? How am I going to not hurt myself today? How am I going to not, like, tell that person to fuck off? Like, to go from that into, wow, you know, how can I be of service today? Like, what's going to happen today? Like, this is kind of exciting. This is a psychic change. This is a psychic change that I think people talk about, you know? And so it wasn't just about the alcohol, you know? I always thought it was. It was just about the feelings that I had that were so hard to deal with that I try and change. And then in the 9th step, I started making my amends. And I just, you know, my sponsor told me that the amends, I know I've heard a lot like the amends are for you. I get that. But my life had been so, it says the root of our disease is selfishness and self-centeredness. It's like, okay, so I've been selfish and self-centered. I've gone through the lives of people, hurt tornado people's life. They did used to call me a tornado, by the way. And now I'm going to get to the 9th step and make the amends for me. I mean, so she said, these amends are for you, but they're also to give people peace that you've hurt. So when I made my amends, I had to say, these are the ways that I know I've harmed you. And I would like to make the right wrong. Can you tell me how else I've harmed you? That sucks. And listen, actually listen, and have them say, okay, yeah, I understand, I understand, I understand. Is there more? I understand, I understand. How can I make this right? How can I make this right? And I had such a resentment against my mom for not protecting me against my dad for so many years, and I didn't think that that amend was important. Because I was waiting for her to say sorry first. And, you know, I just did it like about 8 months ago. And it was the most powerful amends I've made. From that amends, so many things threaded through my sobriety and my spiritual life that opened up for me. And one of them was being able to finally care for myself. And I would not, I was so, I was more resentful at my mom than my dad because she stood there and watched everything. That was a hard one. I mean, that was really hard. And then, you know, the practices. So as I did the 9th step, the practices of 10th, the 10th step, which is, you know, where have I been selfish today? Where do I own amends? Where have I been dishonest? Which for me always is something. I mean, I'm such a liar. Like, I can lie like that, you know, and not even, sometimes I don't even know I'm lying until I call someone and say, you know what I said? Oh, that is such a lie. It is? And then they're all important, but the most important step for me was the 11th step, which is my meditation and prayer life. And then I was told, like, how am I supposed to get to know somebody if I don't spend time with them? So I didn't spend any time with God. I was just, like, praying here and there in the shower or whatever I was doing. And so I had to, I knew I need God like breath. I without God in my life, without that power, I am dead. I spiritually dead, physically dead, emotionally dead. Whatever the addiction is, I will grab it and kill, it will kill me. So I have to get that relationship right. So I had a spiritual experience like no other, and I'm not going to talk specifically about what it was, and it was in a religious sense, and I do belong to a religion. And it says in the big book, look where religious people are right. So I had this, and it happened to me. I actually didn't go looking for it, but it happened to me, and the power was so great and so huge that from that day forward, my bad dreams stopped, because I used to get really bad night terrors for years and years and years. And so I started developing this relationship with God and with Scott, who I also had always made men higher powers. And I always wanted men to, you know, take care of me and protect me. And, I put him in that position for a long time, and it was a perfect fit. And now we're both doing a lot of work in that area, you know, and I appreciate loving somebody that's in the program and working through this, you know, with me, because I know it hasn't been easy. When I left that marriage, I didn't know how to write a check. I didn't know what the difference between a mortgage and a rent was. I had no idea, you know, what my life was going to look like. I had a small child, and I swear to you, God has provided unbelievable things in my life. I have my own practice that I opened a year ago. I see mostly recovered alcoholics. I got a licensed therapist, and I work my own hours so I can pick up my daughter from school. And I have amazing relationship with my ex-husband, which came through the work of the steps, and he got help too. And we co-parent our daughters together. And people, like, just in her school, her kindergartner teacher's like, I've never seen divorced people like this. And that's a miracle. That's just a miracle. And I had a lot to blame him for. A lot to blame him for. And then, you know, most importantly, the most hurtful one, and miracle for me, is the one that happened with my dad. That was the most miracle. That was because I swore I'd never talk to him again. I never talked to him again. I couldn't even mention his name without feeling something in the pit of my stomach. And I did 11 inventories on him before I got free of that resentment. And now I know for some people, you know, forgiving someone doesn't mean I'm going to keep placing myself in a position to get hurt. But I'm not getting hurt by him anymore, and I have a great relationship with him. And I'm not trying to fix him anymore. And, you know, he's not going to be the dad that walks me down the beach and I can tell my problems too, like I always wanted. But he's him. And I don't condemn him or take my anger out on other people about what happened to me. You know, I feel physical pain still in my back every day, and it reminds me, but it's okay now because I've survived it. I survived it. You know, I survived it, and not many people do. And God helped me survive things that people don't survive. And I know every single person in this room that suffered from this disease that's here sober, even if it's one day to the newcomers, you are surviving. You are living, you are surviving. I am surviving because God, the power of God, took away an addiction and a disease that could kill me. And we're really few. You know, I've seen in 13 years a lot of people that don't make it. And I've seen a lot of people that are spiritually sick and that die not from drinking, but just from going insane without doing step work and getting a life, you know, a life with God. I've seen it. And those of you who've been around, you see it, you know, it's real. It's really real. So, I wanted to share this one thing. Someone said, you know, when you see the light at the end of the tunnel, I've told this to Scott like 8 times this week. I'm so excited. I get obsessive. But this light at the end of the tunnel thing. Okay, you know, you see the light at the end of the tunnel. And then if you think about it, be careful there's no train. But what if there was no tunnel? What if there was no tunnel? See, I get in a tunnel and I focus on what's not working. And I don't see the light that God's given to me. I don't see the blessings in my life and the miracles that have happened because I'm focusing on the tunnel, what's not working, which is my selfishness and self-centeredness and my will and my not trusting that God's going to take care of it all. and that if God took every dollar out of my bank account and took my house away and took my daughter away and took Scott away and took my friends away, I would still be okay. I've gotten to that place in my sobriety today. That is a miracle. I'm not dependent on others anymore to make me happy. And I heard Mark say once that people can't take from me, they can only add to me. And I don't know about tomorrow, but today I feel that way. That I can take care of myself today because of the power of God. And I don't need somebody to take care of me anymore. Because I survived. And God gave me a life. And he gave me a purpose. And if I can give what I have gotten through these rooms, which you guys have given me my life back, I have fulfilled my duty today of staying sober and helping another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. So I just got back from a workshop again. I went to treatment again for a week because I do believe that some of us in the rooms have had so much trauma that we need outside help that you can't get in the steps. And I believe that God directed me into this path that I was with these very skilled people, that I actually got trauma out of my body to where the back pain is half of as bad. So I don't believe that. I do believe in outside help. The book talks about it. And I've had to have every area of the program, the step work, the outside help, the sponsees, the sponsors, you know, everything. Am I done? I'm almost done. Okay. 2 minutes. Okay, good. I had a feeling. So anyhow, I just, you know, I'm just really honored and grateful to stand up here today and tell you that I love my life today, that my life is a never-ending parade of miracles, that tomorrow is Mother's Day, so happy Mother's Day to all you mothers. I have a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful six-year-old daughter whose mom is present for her and peaceful with her, who meditates with her and directs her thoughts to God. And on a daily basis, I tell my daughter, you can take care of yourself. You are okay. Even when you feel pain, you are not alone because God has you and you have yourself. One day you won't need me because you have yourself and God. I might not always be here, but you have yourself and God. And that's the miracle of this program. So happy Mother's Day, and thanks for letting me share.